If I had a hammer, I'd hammer in the morning.
I'm Jean Ferraca. Coming up on Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. Pete Seeger, The Power of Song, a new documentary about legendary singer-songwriter Pete Seeger, directed by Jim Brown and produced by Toshi Seeger, Pete's wife of 62 years, is touring the country. Pete was a member of the American Communist Party for a period and used music to organize labor unions. Subsequently, he was blacklisted. While Pete sang about unions, civil rights, the environment, and peace, the government tried to censor him. He was kept off commercial television for 17 years, and his concerts were picketed. He never backed down and always stood by his principles. Up next, American patriot Pete Seeger joins us right after this news.
Bienvenue.
Bienvenido.
Magandang araw sa inyo.
Dobrý deň.
Bienvenue.
Volcherov. Go here on Earth.
Here on here Earth. On Earth.
Welcome to Here on Earth. Earth.
Here on Earth.
Bienvenido a Here on Earth.
Nobody can put in words exactly what the power of song is, any more than you can put in words exactly what you think the power of God is. You just feel there's something there.
To everything, turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose under heaven. A time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to reap, a time to kill, a time to heal, a time to laugh, a time to weep, to everything.
Movie critics have been saying that it's hard to watch Jim Brown's new documentary about legendary folk singer-songwriter Pete Seeger and not sing along. For me, it was hard not to stand up and cheer. Pete Seeger is one of those amazing human beings who's managed to get through 88 years of life without compromise. And God knows he had all kinds of reasons to bend and yield, having been forced to testify before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee during the McCarthy era, having been blacklisted and banned from television for 17 years. Through it all, he stood firm, fighting for labor unions, for civil rights, for the environment, and against the Vietnam War. He even cleaned up the Hudson River, and he did it all through the power of song. I'm Jean Ferraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. This hour, Pete Seeger and the power of song. What makes a patriot? Does the label communist still carry a charge? How are people being branded and blacklisted today? Who or what is being censored? We're at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is hereonearth@wpr.org. You can also join us by AOL or MSN Instant Messenger using our screen name, Here on Earth Radio. I wonder how many of you have seen the film, the documentary. It happens to be playing in Madison at Westgate all this week. I was there last evening with a little gaggle of oldies but goodies, you might say. And everybody applauded after the documentary was over. It's just that kind of thing. It's hard not to feel proud of the American tradition that Pete Seeger represents. We are waiting for him to join us, and he is, in fact, with us now. Pete Seeger.
They just put me on the air, Gene.
I'm so glad. I have to tell you, you've got me hyped up. It was a really wonderful experience watching that documentary. And seeing you chopping wood and carrying water at the grand old age of 88, and still living in the same log cabin you built yourself?
Well, actually, a few years ago we moved out because our daughter and her husband were having their second child, and their house wasn't fixed up yet. So our granddaughter was born on the floor of the log cabin. And now I had money. We had some regular carpenters build a more normal house where we live. But it's only 50 feet away.
Oh, it was a real treat to see you there and to know what a Luddite you are, being so anti-technology. You really did live out the Thoreauvian ethic, you know, simplify, take to the woods. And you were the first green one. And you know, I think you were the first one to establish a real green lifestyle before that ever became a buzzword.
Well, I was a nature nut as a kid. Did you ever hear of a writer named Ernest Thompson Seton? He was born in Scotland, raised in Canada, and wrote a whole lot of books for teenage boys about wildlife, animals. Wild animals I have known. And Rolf in the Woods got me into his books. A teenager boy, this is 200 years ago, runs away from home because his stepfather is beating him. And there's a lone Indian living in the Connecticut woods, trapping a few animals and trading them for some coffee at the local general store. Well, he says, "Can I stay overnight with you? My stepfather's going to beat me." So he stays overnight in the wigwam. In the morning, the stepfather comes, "Oh, you're with the Indian. I'll get my gun." And now they're both in trouble. And they flee up the Hudson Valley, get jobs in a local farm, and make enough money to buy some traps, and they head into the Adirondacks. And every chapter of the book is another lesson about living in the woods.
So that was one of your formative influences.
That's right. Way back when I was 8 years old, I read every book Seton ever read.
And what about your attachment to the Hudson Valley?
Well, my grandparents lived a few miles east of here, near the Connecticut line. And I was born in a hospital in New York City. My parents taught in what's now Juilliard Institute. But they split young, when I was young. And I was sent away to a boarding school in Connecticut where I got a scholarship. And again, they had lots of woods there. I set up a teepee out in the woods and so on.
You know, one of the things, I think it's a classic. I don't know how many American families have the photograph, as you had, of yourself dressed up as an Indian brave with the breech clout and the headband and the war paint and the bow and arrow.
I never hit anything. I remember shooting at rabbits and missing them every time.
But you really have, in a way, you've lived a lifestyle that more typified 19th century than the 20th century, I think.
Certainly, I didn't have to live in the city too much. I confess I was very prejudiced against cities. At age 3, I remember waking up at 1 o'clock with a lot of honking of horns, and I look out the window, and there was a traffic jam. No car moving. And I said, cities are stupid. Why does anybody live in a city? They're too big, too dirty, too noisy, too crowded. The funny thing is now, at this age of life, I think cities may save the world. And you know why?
Why?
Because in cities, you learn to live next door to somebody who has a different religion, a different colored skin, and you have to ride on the same subway or shop in the same stores. And they learn what people in small towns haven't learned yet, but sooner or later we all got to learn.
But what's so interesting about that is that you sort of urbanized your own family. You married Toshi, and I think she's Japanese.
Her father was Japanese. Her mother was old Virginie. I used to call her a World War I hippie.
And one of your grandsons is Hispanic?
That's right.
And so, without having to leave the woods, you managed to get multicultural. How'd you do it?
Well, I'm a reader. And in my early days, I was a member of the Communist Party, which was all for working people of the world to get together. I drifted out about 60 years ago, not quite, 1950 when we moved up here. On the other hand, I think still, I tell people, do you realize our ancestors were all communists? If you go back thousands of years, they lived in tribes. A tribe was, it's called tribal communism by anthropologists.
Uh-huh.
If somebody shot a deer, they couldn't, there was no freezer they could put it in. It was shared. And if there was hunger in the tribe, everybody was hungry, even the chief and the chief's wife and children. There was no idea that one person would be hungry and the person next to him have a full belly.
So what attracted you to the Communist Party initially?
Well, it was back when people didn't know what to do about Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And Litvinov, the Russian representative to the League of Nations, stood up and said, all aggressors should be quarantined, that is, boycotted, the way South Africa was boycotted for many years when they had apartheid. He said, but France and England and the rest of the League of Nations just kind of laughed at him, because their strategy actually was said out loud by Truman when he was a senator from Missouri. He said, I think we should get Hitler and Stalin fighting, and we should help the one who's losing, and when they're both so weak, then they won't either of them give us any trouble. Well, on paper, it looked like a good strategy, but of course, Stalin pulled out the rug from under him by signing a non-aggression pact with Hitler. And he said, you're going to sick him on me, I'll sick him on you. And World War II broke out in 1939.
You were in the military for a while.
Yes, I was drafted in 1942. At first, they wouldn't send me overseas because of my lefty background. I was questioned eventually by military intelligence and convinced them I wouldn't do anything unpatriotic. I said, I actually got a furlough a year after I was in the Army, just about that time, and did something I'd always disapproved of. I used pull. My father had a job in Washington back in the Roosevelt administration, and he knew a major in what's called special services. And I was interviewed by a major in the Pentagon, said, I can lead songs. Maybe if they don't want me to carry a gun, let me carry my banjo. And I turned out to be very busy on the island of Saipan in the Western Pacific for a couple of years. I was in charge of hospital entertainment, and I'd bounce around the island in a jeep and put up a mimeograph poster on the bulletin board saying, if you can entertain or make music, telephone this number. There are 10,000 wounded on their way back from Iwo Jima or Okinawa, and they could use some cheering up. So I booked string bands and gospel quartets and jazz combos and sang along with them half the time.
Did you ever consider becoming a conscientious objector?
Well, I have some relatives who were. My brother wrote my grandmother, he said, don't we have some Quaker ancestors? I have to convince the draft board I'm a genuine conscientious objector. And she wrote a brisk letter to him. He said, one should not have to have Quaker ancestors to be against war, but it so happens you do, which he told him about John Opbellen way back in the 17th century, who became a Quaker. And his wife was more conservative. She went to the regular church, but there she heard a sermon, that man Opbellen will fry in hell for all eternity. And she ran home in tears and threw herself into her husband's arms saying, darling, tell me about this new religion. I'd rather go to hell with you than to heaven without you. And she became the one who, when William Penn got a grant from Charles II, I think William Penn's father had given a whole lot of money to Charles II's father or something, whenever, and he said, we'll forget about that debt, but could I take a boatload of people over and found a colony in America, North America? And so my ancestors were on the first boat to Philadelphia.
Why am I not surprised? We're talking this hour with Pete Seeger. There's a new documentary that's touring the country. It's at the Westgate Theater in Madison right now for the whole week. It's called Pete Seeger, The Power of Song, and it is terrific. I'm Jean Ferraca. It's a great privilege, I think, to be speaking with Pete Seeger this hour, and you can be as well. 1-800-642-1234 is the number to call. I'd like to raise some questions about what it means to be a patriot. The song we started with, Turn, 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 in a way has become Pete Seeger's life story. He was dishonored during the 50s, brought up in disgrace before the House Un-American Activities Committee during the McCarthy era, testified before Congress, was blacklisted, was banned from television, lost his livelihood, and then he was recently honored by President Clinton as a great American artist, citizen artist is the way he likes it described. So what makes a patriot? And does that label communist still carry the same charge? 1-800-642-1234.
They're all in uniform. Oh, when will we ever learn? Oh, when will we ever learn?
I'm Jean Faraca. Internationally acclaimed artist and filmmaker Peter Cease talks about his new picture book memoir, The Wall, Growing Up Behind the Iron Curtain. Originally intended for his children, it's a cautionary tale that reminds us not to take democracy and freedom for granted. Join us Wednesday at 3, here on Earth, Radio Without Borders.
Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include Park Printing House of Verona and its employees, who invite you to join them in supporting Wisconsin Public Radio. To learn how your company can become a public radio supporter, please call 800-747-7444.
In Peekskill, New York, a sign of the times. The pro-Soviet singer Paul Robeson was scheduled to perform, and a surge of anti-communist feeling burst into violence and riot.
The concert took place. I sang a few songs, and then Robeson sang for an hour, and we all congratulated ourselves.
When the time came to leave, the people against the concert were lined up on the side of the road.
Around the corner was a pile of stones, waist high, each stone about as big as a baseball. Wham! And then around the next corner was another pile of stones. Wham! From the other side.
All I can remember is Takashi, my Japanese grandfather, he shoved my head right down to the floor and just got me out of the line of fire. And I gather every window was broken in the car.
That's an excerpt from the documentary Pete Seeger, The Power of Song. And that last voice was the voice of Dan Seeger, Pete's son, who is heard throughout the documentary. They were talking about the infamous 1949 Peekskill concert, where Seeger shared the stage with the late Paul Robeson. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. Paul Robeson left the United States. I think he was driven out, actually. And he went to the Soviet Union. I think you visited the Soviet Union, but you didn't stay.
Well, Robeson actually just toured. He was touring Europe and went to Russia and found a place where he didn't feel that his color of his skin mattered, that he was welcomed. When I finally got my passport in 1962, my wife and I decided we'd travel around the world and see as many different kinds of places as we could.
And you took the whole family?
Took three children. Danny was now grown up. He was only 3 years old at Peekskill, but now he was 17. And his younger sister was 15, and a little girl who now, of course, she's now 50, she's 52 now, but she was only 8 years old then. Well, the kids, we took them out of school, and later they said it was the most educational year they could have ever spent.
Yeah, there's a little bit of footage from the news, from the, what was the camera that you used?
We had a cheap newsreel camera,
yeah, that was
secondhand,
it.
And black and white film. We couldn't afford color film. Taking movies was expensive in those days. This was before they had DVDs and all these things now. But we filmed the local music in Asia, East Africa and West Africa, and Europe, East Europe and West Europe. And as I say, when we came home, the kids said it was a very educational trip.
Well, what we saw in the documentary, just very brief clips, very memorable. The people doing the rice song, the rice dance in Japan, singers and dancers in Ghana and Tanzania. Real folk stuff that probably doesn't even exist anymore.
Well, it might not, but you never can tell. My wife was the photographer, and she was a very good photographer. She wanted to do more, but this has been her problem. She was married to an overly busy person, and so things she wanted to do got put aside. And it's one of the biggest mistakes I've made in my life. Right now, of course, our problem is too much mail. Most men tie their wives to a sink, but Toshi's been tied to a table of paper.
But anyway, back to the Soviet Union. You did visit. What were your impressions?
Well, I could see they didn't have the kind of freedom of speech we had, but they allowed me to sing anything I wanted, and I concentrated in singing songs of the civil rights movement. Dr. Martin Luther King really turned my mind around in many different ways. I'd thought of myself as an atheist, but I have to confess that it was a Baptist preacher who really turned my mind around, and in more recent times, it's a Catholic priest. I've gone down to Fort Benning, Georgia in the mid-November when there is a demonstration against what used to be called the School of the Americas.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
And it's a wonderful man, Father Roy Bourgeois.
He was on this program.
Oh, really?
Yeah, a very powerful man.
Well, you know what it is. And he's kept it peaceful all these years. He asked the crowd, please repeat after me. I will not carry any weapons on me. And the whole crowd repeats it. I will not shout insulting words at the police. And the whole crowd repeats that phrase. And then, about 10 pledges later, is a most important one. If I cannot agree with these pledges of nonviolence, I will disassociate myself from the demonstration.
Hmm.
So he's managed to keep it peaceful for 15 years now, and sooner or later, we're all pretty confident Congress is going to put that crazy school. You know, they used to teach torture,
mm-hmm.
assassination.
Mm-hmm.
Bishop Romero in El Salvador gave us a sermon saying people should be allowed to vote for whoever they want. Next thing, he was assassinated by graduates of the School of the Americas.
And how did Martin Luther King Jr. influence you?
Well, first of all, when he started the bus boycott, he insisted, we are going to win this boycott if we are nonviolent. The ultimate weakness of violence is it just increases hate. With hate, you can murder the hater, but you don't get rid of hate, you just increase hate.
Hmm.
Darkness cannot drive out darkness. It takes light to do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. It takes love, and I'd say respect, to do that.
You had an instance in your life where an assassin showed up at one of your concerts, fully intending to kill you.
Well, he was a rather quiet guy, and I first didn't know whether to believe him, but his friend said, yeah, later on, this guy said, when Seeger sings in this town, I'm going to kill him. All I know is, this guy said, Pete Seeger, could I talk to you a minute? I came here intending to kill you. And there were a lot of things going on. I was kind of busy. I thought maybe I'd just shake hands, but Toshi said, sit down. And we talked, and then we sang Where Have All the Flowers Gone together, both of us. And he stood up and shook my hand. He says, I feel clean now.
You know, I can't imagine an anecdote that better illustrates the power of song.
Yeah. Well, he had been from a small town, and they'd all gone to serve in Vietnam, and a whole batch of his friends had been killed, and he was just furious. Who was this crazy Seegers stabbing me in the back with these songs?
So he resented your anti-war stance.
Well, he did when he was in Vietnam, but he listened to the whole program. We got the whole crowd singing This Land Is Your Land and singing other songs of different places. I'm now convinced that if there's a world here in 100 years, it's going to be tens of millions of little things. not any one big thing at all is going to save this world. But it might be if some women and children starting a community garden in some city. Do you know there are 800 community gardens in Manhattan now?
Mm-hmm. You know, this reminds me of something that we heard from Paul Hawken just the other day. He's written a book called Blessed Unrest.
I've ordered 6 copies of his book. I just read it. It's a great book.
Uh-huh. And he really makes the same claim. He says that it's the grassroots rising that's going to save us. And he interconnects all of these various local organizations and NGOs. And
wasn't that a great subtitle for a book?
Yes.
How did the biggest movement in the world come so suddenly and nobody predicted its coming?
Yeah, exactly. Now, was that a cell phone I heard?
It could have been somebody else's, but it wasn't mine.
Okay, we have callers who want to join in here. Art joins us from Middleton. Hi, Art.
Yes, we would like to believe that love brings reconciliation, Mr. Seeger, but what do you think the effect of that would have been in confronting the Nazi doctrine and action of the 40s? And if, when you look at the world empire today, and if you've studied about 9/11 and government complicity in 9/11, what would be your stance toward that evil?
Thanks, Art. Go ahead.
I've often wondered. I have friends who are pacifists, as I've told you, I had a brother. I think I agree with Einstein. It was, the crisis was such that he told told President Roosevelt, better start trying to make an atom bomb, because if Hitler gets it, there's no hope for the world. On the other hand, Einstein late in life is supposed to have said, there are two infinite things. One is the universe, and the other is human stupidity. And then he says, I'm not sure about the universe.
That reminds me of something very bold that you did, and maybe a little stupid, come to think of it, when you were invited back by Tommy Smothers, the Smothers Brothers, after 17 years of being banned from television. And what did you choose to sing? But I think one of your most biting songs, Waist Deep in the Big Muddy.
Yeah. Well, I've been aware of this problem all my life. Plato is supposed to have written 2,000 years ago, it's very important not to allow the wrong kind of music in the Republic.
Mm.
And there's an old Arab proverb, when the king puts the poet on his payroll, he cuts off the tongue of the poet. And I've often thought of that if I get a job on television.
Well, you did for a while. You had the Hootenanny show, and it failed.
Well, it wasn't. I wasn't that experienced. It had some wonderful performers on it. Mississippi John Hurt, the 70-year-old blues man from Mississippi.
Hmm.
And oh my gosh.
Real authentic stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tell us about the place of failure in your life.
Well, in a sense, every time I quit singing somewhere, I think, oh, why didn't I sing that song? Or why did I muff that opportunity? I'll have to try again. This is what the extraordinary title of Paul Hawken's book means, Blessed Unrest. The phrase was invented by the great dancer Martha Graham in 1926, speaking to young Agnes DeMille. All us artists are always trying to achieve the impossible and never quite making it, but keeping on trying. We're filled with a blessed unrest.
But I'm thinking, as soon as you said that, I immediately thought of one of your greatest triumphs, which seems to me the Clearwater Project, which, well, listen to what Arlo Guthrie had to say about it.
Pete wants to clean up the river. Everybody says, Pete, you can't clean up the river. The river's too big. It's not enough people. Nobody's going to help you. Blah, 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 blah. That didn't stop Pete. Except we thought, well, I think we need to build a sloop. And we'll sail it up and down the river. And people will come to the river to see the sloop. And they'll look down and say, look, there's shit in the river. We have to do something. And everybody said, Pete, it's not really a great idea. It's not gonna work. But you know what? Of course it worked.
One more time, sailing up.
Sailing up.
Sailing down.
Sailing down.
Up.
Down.
Up and down the river, sailing on. Stopping all along the way.
So, if it hadn't been Pete Seeger who was on the Clearwater sloop, do you think it would have been so successful?
Well, nobody knows. I do know one thing, though. A great philosopher, Eric Hoffer, got off the line, creativity is nice, but maintenance is the essential art of civilization. Isn't that great? And all I did was plant a seed, and then thousands of young people came along and helped sail the boat and raise money for it and so on.
How long did it take altogether from the light bulb that went off that made you want to do this and the actual river being a place where people, your own daughter, could swim?
I think it was in January 1946 when I wrote a letter to a friend who loaned me a book about these beautiful old boats. They had 400 of them in the 1860s. They carried bricks to build growing New York and Catskill lumber and hay for New York's horses. In the early days, they carried passengers. Alexander Hamilton wrote one of the Federalist Papers on a sloop bound for Poughkeepsie. Well, all I knew was they were beautiful boats, and I write a letter to a friend. They built a replica of the Mayflower. Why don't we get some people together and build a replica of a Hudson River sloop? Life size! And 3 years later, we'd raised enough money to get the keel laid, and then we had to go into really push to get the rest. It cost $140,000, which was a lot more money than prices have gone up. It would cost $1 million now.
Mm.
And then we got a singing crew. We had to borrow some money to pay the last $50,000, but we sang our way from Maine, where the boat was built, down to New York, and every night we raised a little money. So we managed to pay off the loans, and then we discovered how to teach kids. It was a young fellow just out of college. He says, don't try and speak to 50 kids all at once. Divide them up into 5 groups, and 10 of them can put a net in the water and catch some fish. 10 of them can look through a microscope. 10 of them can put their hands on a tiller and push it from side to side, as the captain tells them, so on. So they worked out a method of teaching science as well as a little history, and sing a few songs, tell a few jokes. Now there are some 10 other boats around America doing their Clearwater job in their home territory.
And there again, we've got that same Paul Hawken pattern of little groups here and there that all together are making a big difference.
Absolutely. Paul's a small businessman, you know. Smith and Hawken are a famous company selling very good tools.
Garden tools.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And I've met him 1 or 2 times, a very nice guy, and I think that it's going to be an absolutely exciting next few decades as all around the country people find there's something you can do.
Well, you better plan on hanging around, because we're going to need you to sing us through it.
Well, I'm old grandpa, not just dozens or hundreds, there's actually thousands of people. They sing in schools, they sing in coffee houses, they sing with their family, they sing in church or wherever. And their songs are to help people get together, even though they may disagree about this or disagree about that. Sometimes it's a silly song or a fun song, sometimes a very deeply serious song.
Well, we're hearing a very deeply serious song right now. This is Waist Deep in the Big Muddy. It was actually inspired by your watching American soldiers cross over the Mekong River in Vietnam. And, you know, the lyrics really work today, I'm sorry to say. Let's listen as we go into this break.
We heard a gurgling cry. A few seconds later, the captain's helmet was all that floated by. The sergeant said, "Turn around, men, I'm in charge from now on." And we just made it out of the big muddy with the captain dead and gone. We stripped and dived and found his body stuck in the old quicksand. I guess he didn't know that the water was deeper than the place he'd once before been. Another stream had joined the big muddy about a half mile from where we'd gone. We were lucky to escape from the big muddy when the big fool said to push on. Well, I'm not going to point any moral, I'll leave that for yourself. Maybe you're still walking, you're still talking, you'd like to keep your health. But every time I read the paper...
This year, Wisconsin Public Radio will give about 500 businesses and organizations a way to support quality WPR programming. We'll thank these businesses by airing announcements recognizing their support. To find your local underwriting representative, call 1-800-747-7444.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Hemp and Goods, offering products made from hemp, organic cotton, bamboo, and other eco-fibers. Open Monday through Saturday from 11 until 7. Hemp and Goods is located at 911 Williamson Street.
I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. This hour, we're talking with Pete Seeger. There's a new documentary that's touring the country about his life and his work. It's called simply Pete Seeger, The Power of Song. We're at 1-800-642-1234. We have a number of callers. I'm going to get to them in just a minute. But first, we have another excerpt from the film. This is when you were testifying in Congress before the House Un-American Activities Committee. And you were asked by journalists right after your testimony about the testimony that you gave.
Mr. Seeger, you specifically declined the protection of the Fifth Amendment and refusing to answer the committee's questions. Can you tell us why?
Well, I told the committee that in all my life, I've never committed any kind of act, conspiratorial or even conducive. And I resented the implication that by being called before the committee, that because my opinions might be different than Mr. Walters, he has a right to his opinion, I have to mine.
Judge Murphy said, I have determined that Mr. Seeger should have answered these questions. So I was declared guilty. However, after 7 years, the appeals court acquitted me.
And nobody's asked you if you were fearful that you would go to jail.
I'm probably very stupid, but I'm not fearful.
And why weren't you fearful? And I guess more importantly, why weren't you angry? Why weren't you bitter at what happened?
I can't say exactly that, I get angry at myself sometimes for doing stupid things, but try not to. Try to keep a level head as much as possible. The big problem in the whole world today is people letting anger take over. We've got to learn how to talk with each other, even though we may disagree strongly, even hate each other. But if we don't learn to talk together, we're in deep trouble.
We have Tara joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Tara, go ahead.
Hi. I am so incredibly thrilled to talk to you. You have been my hero since I can remember. And most heroes you grow up and out of, but you are such a man of incredible integrity and vision. And the question I want to ask is, it certainly seems to me that we are knee-deep in the big muddy without any mud. And what should we be doing? Should we be out on the streets? What should we be doing to get out of this terrible war?
I think we should be trying to work in our home communities, wherever we are. Every Saturday I go up to a street corner. It's a very busy corner where every hour thousands of cars have to stop for a stoplight because two big roads cross each other. And I'm standing there with a few peace signs, and we have an American flag there and a peace flag and a couple others. It's just a small little thing, but it's lets our home community know that there's people who say, let's start talking. Find a way to start talking.
Thank you, Tara. We have Steve joining us next in Kansasville. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
It's a real honor to be able to speak with Pete this afternoon, and I want to say how much we've enjoyed his music over the years. And second, his idea that we have to act at a community level. I'm one of the founders of Burlington Area Progressives, which is in a small, very conservative southeastern Wisconsin city. And for the past 3 years, we've been putting on small events and film showings and having speakers talking about progressive issues. Just last week, we were talking about the electric car, and I know that Pete drives an electric car, and I was wondering if he'd want to talk about that.
Oh, yeah, for about 10 years, I go to town and back. My little electric car is just one step ahead of a golf cart. It can take me 15 to 20 miles at most, and not very fast. I joke that I can get it up to 40 or 50 if the wind's with me. I have to lug around 1,500 pounds of lead-acid batteries to get the little 25-horsepower electric motor to run this little. It's a little pickup truck. It was made by a school teacher, who wanted to show his students what could be done if they wanted to become mechanics. And there's even a small business up in New Hampshire called Electric Vehicles of America. You can get their little booklet from them. They tell you where to buy the fuses and the motors and the switches. There's even a thing called an inertia switch. So if I hit a tree or somebody else hits me, it cuts all the current off so I don't get electrocuted.
Thank you very much for that question, Steve. We'll go to Kevin next in Roberts. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hello. I'm proud to talk to Pete Seeger. I've got MS. I have trouble speaking, and he's brought some sunshine into my life. I just started listening to him for about the last 2 years. And him and Arlo Guthrie. And
how old are you, Kevin?
I'm 48 years old.
Ah, your voice sounds very young.
Well, I got MS when I was 41, and I kind of look young for my age, but I've been better.
Well, don't give up. Don't give up. You never can tell. And if we... I think one of these days they're going to find out how to cure it.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, tell us, Pete, about the healing power of music.
No one can prove a darn thing. I guess if I didn't believe that music does affect things, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. But I've seen a crowd of people who are just feeling kind of confused, get enthusiastic when they find they can all sing together. Help sometimes if I give them the words. In church they call it lining out the hymn.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll find a song where they know the tune but maybe don't know the words. In fact, quite often I sing old pop songs like Over the Rainbow. You know, the rainbow is in a sense the symbol of the world to come. It's a famous spiritual says, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, fire next time.
Mm.
And so I'll say, you know this tune. I go, boom, 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 somewhere over the rainbow. You sing it. And that crowd is singing, and I'll say, way up high. And they sing that, way up high. There's a land I heard of once in a lullaby. There's a land. And at the end, when they get a little harmony, now I say, let's sing it a second time. Now you know the words. I don't need to shout them out. You can sing it the whole song. And we end on harmony with a few people hitting high notes.
Mm-hmm. What is it about getting people to sing along with you that really turns you on?
Well, I confess, I'm of two minds about inventions. John Philip Sousa says, "What will happen to the American voice now the phonograph's been invented?" And it's true. Men used to sing in bars. Women used to sing lullabies to their kids. And it's not so common now. On the other hand, you never can tell. Because I think people are learning that it's fun. It's fun to do things yourself, even though you may not be expert or professional. It's like it's a lot of fun to play some sport together.
The whole business of singing along, sing-alongs, I suppose we call them, we don't do that much anymore. I mean, there might be a sing-along in a nursing home, for example. People don't know the old songs the way they used to, and they don't have that experience of I think I would call it an ecstatic experience of being part of something that's much larger than themselves. When you hear, for example, in We Shall Overcome, that chorus that's behind you, and there's that sense of, well, it's real power coming through the collective song.
We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand someday. Deep in my heart,
so how do we get it back, Pete? How do we get that spirit back? How do we get that sense of ourselves as the body politic?
It's going to happen within the next few decades. We're going to see wonderful things happening. You know, some big things, very terrible, are going on. But do you ever stop to think the harder a ball bounces on the sidewalk, the higher it bounces afterward? And I think we're going to see some very good things happening in the next few decades as people realize we can work together more than we thought.
Mm. We have Sheila joining us next from Madison. Sheila, go ahead. Thanks for your call.
Yes. I was with Eugene last night. I was one of the gaggle of oldies and goodies. And I cheered very loud at the end. But I also cried during the movie. And I cried, I think, because I was crying for the loss of the courage that it took somebody like Pete Seeger and also the family that I grew up with to demonstrate displeasure with what was going on. I just don't see that anymore. And I also wanted to say that something the movie didn't show were the little things that Pete Seeger did. An uncle of mine knew Pete Seeger, was friendly with him in Chicago, and I happened to have a recording of Pete Seeger and the Weavers coming up to my uncle's hospital room and singing "Goodnight, Irene" for him. And he was also about to become a grandfather, and they sang "Hush, Little Baby." And I have that recording, and I treasure it.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yes, and so I just want to thank you, Pete, in person. I don't know if you even remember that incident, but it meant a lot to my uncle, and he recovered from his heart attack after that.
Oh, my gosh, I may not remember his name. My memory for names is gone.
Well,
I remember the Weavers were in Chicago. I think we were playing at the Palmer House, I think.
Right. His name was Mandel. I'll give you his first name, Mandel Terman, actually.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Yes.
And his daughter was a good artist.
That's right, Shelley, my cousin. So thank you. And I cheered, and as I said, I cried, and I hope we get your idealism back in this society again.
And that toughness, that spirit, that, you know, I'm standing firm, no matter, I am who I am, this is what I believe, I'm taking the First Amendment. It was really greatly inspiring. Pancho's next in Milwaukee. Pancho, go ahead.
Hi.
Pancho, you have to turn down your radio in order for us to hear you right.
Okay, thank you for having me on. It's a great honor for me to be able to speak to Pete Seeger. I've been an admirer of his for a long time, and he is like-minded with my parents and myself on the nonviolence issues and so forth. But my question has to do with, I understand that you did an album in Esperanto, the international language, and I would like to hear a little bit about that, if possible.
Thanks, Pancho.
Well, I wish I had, but it was just talked about. We never got around to doing it. Mm. And I've often wondered why Esperanto did not catch on more. I think it was a very European language, and many countries in Asia, not just China, India, but many small ones, felt it was too European. On the other hand, you might consider that you can laugh about it. English has almost become an international language, because if you want to be in business, you have to know English. And one of the best songs I have was put together by Josh White Jr. called English is Crazy. It's really a rap. English is the most widely used language in the history of the planet. One out of every 7 human beings can speak or read it. It has the largest vocabulary. But face it, English is crazy.
I never thought I'd hear Pete Seeger rapping on here on Earth. You know, what's so interesting among many things about you is you have this incredibly rich past. Really, you embody the great events of the 20th century, but you're all about the future.
I guess that's what occupies my mind most of the time. How are we going to get these people together? Palestinians and Israelis, Serbians and Bosnians, North Korea, South Korea. Who knows? Who knows? On the other hand, there's not only music, but all arts is going to play a part in it. And you might consider food. There's never been a country which has experimented with so many different kinds of food.
Pete Seeger, what a treat. What a treat. Thank you for being you.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Tell us a little bit about this song as we go out. We just have a few seconds. Where is it in the Pete Seeger canon, in the songbook? How close to the top?
I'm trying to recognize the song.
Oh, play it a little louder, Joe.
Oh, you should know the man who wrote the words, Lee Hayes.
Okay.
He was a real genius. He was the son of a Methodist preacher in Arkansas, and he knew that some of the greatest gospel tunes just changed one word and you had a new verse.
We gotta go. Thank you so much for being with us. And I want to thank Tom Martin Erickson for making this program possible. Thank you all so much.